Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And it is all about constitutional compliance. We are happy to be able to endorse and have somebody sign the pledge of committing to the Constitution. That person happens to be, you guessed it, Gerald Wistrand, and he's running a statewide campaign in Missouri. I can only ask you to support that campaign. If we can highlight and bring forward one person out of this election that will actually take a stand on the Constitution, prove me wrong, folks. Let's get this guy in. Let's give him some support. And that way, we can actually go down this path of seeing what can happen when we actually have a leader leading on the Constitution. We haven't had that yet. Ron Paul has never done that. Rand Paul has never done that. Ted Cruz has never done that. All of these guys continually lay upon the redefined Constitution that how the courts have perverted us, how the courts have literally gone down this path, as I was saying at the end of last show, that we're in a stranglehold because the courts have constantly redefined every aspect of that Constitution. Where you don't even have to be a citizen to be entitled to liberties, rights, and even voting. They're literally judges that they've completely watered down and marginalized what it is to be a citizen in this republic. And actually, the framers were very clear. The framers made it that if you were going to be a citizen, you had a responsibility to support and defend the Constitution against enemies foreign and domestic. You don't just come here and vote to destroy us. You have to become a citizen first. The fact that the judges have done what they have done, to me, this needs to be the wake-up call of how and what we need to do to fix the judiciary, to get it back into the framework of the Constitution, to where our judges and our state and federal courts and even county courts, I believe county is where the common law courts need to be. And I think it's a divine hand of providence that it was never pulled in at any state level. I think that the fact that they let that go, they just said, oh, well, everything. We're going to take over everything. When it was never defined. And I believe that that omission was divine. Because now we can actually lay it out that the common law courts will be retained at the county level. That there may be an appellate level when we rewrite the state constitution, that the state court may have the ability to hear appeals from counties. But that doesn't mean that they have jurisdiction at any, the beginning or what have you. And bottom line is, do you have an appeal, Sean? Welcome back, Sean. Have you ever heard of anybody have an appeal regarding their divorce? And you may be muted, I'm not sure. But the question is, I've never heard an instance where somebody was dissatisfied, maybe regarding the custody of a child, but the outcome of splitting and everything else. I guess there are some cases where there's that much money on the line to where they, go through this appeal process or mitigation or arbitration, what have you. But are you familiar with anything like that?
They definitely have arbitration.
Yeah.
When I was in the military, I went through that, and we had to meet certain criteria before we could move forward and come to agreement. But that was probably just a military case.
Yeah, okay.
They pretty much own you.
Okay, but the question is an appeal. So once the divorce is finalized, once the decree has been done, then it gets appealed. Could it be appealed to the state level or federal level even? And it's never gone there. Why is that? At least I'm not familiar with that. I've heard the struggles and the fights and the continuance of a divorce. And we've actually seen, you know, divorces at the national level, like, you know, I'll say the stupid Johnny Depp divorce, as, you know, as polarized as people were over that. Come on. I mean, it's a sad thing when people, you know, marry people and realize the person they married isn't the person that they thought they were, you know, or what, for whatever reason. These are sad indictments of our society, but, you know, to be gripped in the outcome and the drama and all of that, I just have to laugh. But my point is that we see these things, and these are high-profile divorces. But come on, I've never seen one where it goes up to somebody making this claim that their rights were violated by the decree of the court, the civil rights. And I think one of the reasons why they don't want to do that is because they've already started trampling on parental rights at the state courts and at the federal level. Boy, how dare you assert that a father has parental rights? I mean, but that's the essence, isn't it? And we've actually seen, I guess there have been cases, but maybe I'm just not, I don't follow family law to that degree, but I guess there may be cases where there are appeals where one court or a judge basically determines that the mother can make, you know, decisions regarding the changing the gender of a child where the husband isn't happy with that, and so forth and so on. But anyway, the point is, though, folks, that common law courts, and technically divorce was done at a religious level. The fact that the courts took over, because marriages were done at the religious level, there was no such thing as a civil divorce. When the framers were walking and working and pounding out the Constitution, there was no such thing as a civil marriage. I've yet to see anybody prove that a state had the authority to marry people. That was always done by the churches. That was always done because sometimes you had interfaith marriages or what have you. But for the most part, not. Most of the states were pretty myopic on their religion and religious worship. So anyway.
I mean, the same thing with the birth certificate, correct? It used to be they would just record it in the family Bible and go on from there. But now you have to register your child with the state.
Yes. And the birth itself was actually, for the most part, done within the family. I mean, in the very beginning, the child mortality rate was so high that it was alarming. But they didn't have a clinic down the street. And nature took its course that, you know, mothers were lost during childbirth. If these things were just common, these were the dangers of life. As a matter of fact, if you, I believe McCullough wrote a book on John Adams, and I think it was McCullough in that book, or maybe it was another book regarding the Adams, but they had children, but they never named their children until they hit the age of two, because the infant mortality or death, you know, instant death, sudden death syndrome, what have you, with children, usually it was, the threat was pretty much over at age two. And so that's when they named their children. They would just call the baby the visitor. And the next visitor would, you know, would get a name if they survived, God willing that they survived in this world. You know, people don't know just how easy it is we have it. I mean, the way people crumble emotionally over, you know, a football game. Or over, you know, if you look at how people just lose it emotionally today. Back then, you know, life was hard. It was very difficult. And, you know, there was no tolerance for that. People, they raised their children to be able to withstand the stress, the real stress of living in such a harsh world. So anyway, let's move forward. I want to get through the Pennsylvania debates because we're going to get into the Massachusetts debates, and it is the one out of all of the debates that really has a spiritual focus, a spiritual tone of the, of course, the Puritans. And so I'm looking forward to that because we can see how Massachusetts is a complete, it's a contrast from what we're reading and the tone that we get from basically Wilson. And again, I think Wilson was an outlier because he just had these unique paradigms that didn't necessarily align with the framers. It's not that he created any conflicts in how he defined this clause of the Constitution, that clause, or what have you, but he definitely had a, you know, some outlier paradigms regarding the Constitution philosophically and so forth. But anywho, let's do, we're at this point, folks, we're still under the last section of McCain, right before the very end. It is on page 91, and this is the enumerated and jurisdiction subsection. So let's go ahead and pick that up, Sean. Thanks.
That in all cases enumerated, except where the Supreme Court has original jurisdiction, quote, they shall have appellate jurisdiction both as to law and fact, with such exceptions and under such regulations as the Congress shall make, end quote. From this, it is inferred that the trial by jury is not secured, and an objection is set up to the system because they have jurisdiction between citizens of different states. Regulations under this head are necessary, but the convention could form no one that would have suited each of the United States. It has been a subject of amazement to me to hear gentlemen contend that the verdict of a jury shall be without revision in all cases. Juries are not infallible because they are 12 in number. When the law is so blended with the fact as to be almost inseparable, may not the decision of a jury be erroneous? Yet, notwithstanding this, trial by jury is the best mode that is known. Appellate jurisdiction, sir, is known in the common law, and causes are removed from inferior courts by writs of error into some court of appeal. It is said that the Lord Chancellor in all cases sends down to the lower courts when he wants to determine a fact, but that opinion is not well founded, because he determines 19 out of 20 without the intervention of any jury. The power to try causes between citizens of different states was thought by some gentlemen invidious, but I apprehend they must see the necessity of it from what has been already said by my honorable colleague, quote, that there is no bill or declaration of rights in this Constitution. To this I answer, such a thing has not been deemed essential to liberty, excepting in Great Britain, where there is a king and a house of lords, quite distinct with respect to power and interest from the rest of the people, or in Poland, the Pacta Conventus, which the king signed before he is crowned, and in six states of the American United States.
Okay, so at that point in time, out of the 13 states, six states had a Bill of Rights. And as a matter of fact, when you really look at all of the states, the one that had just created a Bill of Rights was Virginia, George Mason. And that was a pretty lustrous, kind of more comprehensive Bill of Rights than the other states. Because at this point in time, they started seeing how, under the Articles of Confederation, states could actually start doing things because there was no protection in the monarchy anymore. I mean, next, now you have the potential of a state king or a despot, a dictator. You may call him governor. You may call him president. You may call him the executive. Regardless, there was nothing constraining in these states because they had general powers. All 13 states provided general powers to their government, which is why the representatives was the ultimate jury and the ultimate court, the state legislature, I should say, was the ultimate jury and the ultimate court in deciding matters, which is why the power of petition and redress was always meant to go to your legislators, and if not specifically to the state, it could be at your county level. Now he dives into, for this really short part, this enumerated, this one little subparagraph of enumerated. Go ahead.
Again, because it is unnecessary for the powers of Congress being derived from the people in the mode pointed out by this Constitution and being therein enumerated and positively granted can be no other than what this positive grant conveys.
And
lock
so
on civil government.
Yeah, so that's a kind of a sub quote that is being laid out. So again, he's really basically saying that what is granted is being positively granted. When we talk about legislative powers, does the president have any positive legislative powers? He only has negative. He can only stop a law from being a law. He can't create a law and put it into force. Only Congress can do that. And the president can either sign it or veto it. And if he does veto it, Congress still has the positive force ability by two-thirds of both houses overpowering his veto. Now, you've heard me say, and I said this for a long time, that that's a problem. Because there needs to be an ability to literally stop unconstitutional laws from actually getting implemented, that being what it is. This citation of Locke on civil government, as a matter of fact, you know, Locke wrote a couple of books. The Two Treatises of Government is is one I would recommend everybody read, because there's a real focus on this concept of parenthood and this idea of a leader of government, because he challenges this idea where a monarch becomes the parent of government or the parent of the people, where he is the only person that God communes with in governing the people of this earth. And that creates this huge problem. And this is why Locke literally goes through the Bible and points out the different scriptures that talk about how God works with the parents of children, of households. And so he uses, as number one argument he uses as to how God does not walk and talk with the king or the leader of government, is the fact that when Cain slew Abel, the idea based was being propagated that in those days of England, Britain, that the God of Israel, when somebody died, would walk and talk with the king and say, do you know there's been harm done? But in the Bible, it doesn't say that God walked and talked with Adam. He went and approached Cain himself and said, where's thy brother? And again, paraphrasing, but this is where God directly deals with us. And Locke basically says, if this is divine, that it goes all the way back to Adam, then the concept was broken even in Adam's time. That's not how God operates. And this idea that we are to have one person immutable to rule us over all things that God wants us to be ruled by. This was the beginning challenge of the idea of monarchical governments, which is what really helped fuel the framers, Thomas Jefferson and the rest of them, to start really, you know, drinking in this idea of a self-governing government, where, you know, people had, you know, enjoyed liberty to govern themselves to some degree. Anyway, let's go into this last one, which is the delegated subsection. Go ahead.
With respect to executive officers, they have no manner of authority, any of them, beyond what is by a positive grant and commission delegated to them. Quote, that this is a consolidation of the several states and not a confederation, end quote. To this I answer, the name is immaterial. The thing unites the several states and makes them like one, in particular instances and for particular purposes, which is what is ardently desired by most of the sensible men in this country. I care not whether it is called a consolidation, confederation, or national government, or by what other name. If it is a good government and calculated to promote the blessings of liberty, tranquility, and happiness. Quote, it is an aristocracy and was intended to be so by the framers of it. Here again, sir, the name is immaterial. If it is a good system of government for the general and common concerns of the United States, but after the definition which has already been given of an aristocratic government, it becomes unnecessary to repeat arguments to prove that this system does not establish an aristocracy. There have been some other small objections to, or rather criticisms on, this work, which I rest assured the gentlemen who made them will, on reflection, excuse me in omitting to notice. Many parts of this Constitution have been wrested and tortured in order to make way for shadowy objections which must have been observed by every auditor. Some other things were said with acrimony. They seemed to be personal. I heard the sound, but it was inarticulate. I can compare it to nothing better than the feeble noise occasioned by the working of small beer. It holds an argument as well as nature that destructio unius est generatio alterius, the refutation of an argument begets a proof. The objections to this Constitution having been answered and all done away, it remains pure and unhurt, and this alone is a forcible argument of its goodness. Mr. President, I am sure nothing can prevail with me to give my vote for ratifying this Constitution, but a conviction, from comparing the arguments on both sides, that the not doing it is liable to more inconvenience and danger than the doing it. One, if you do it, you strengthen the government and people of these United States and will thereby have the wisdom and assistance of all the states. Two, you will settle, establish, and firmly perpetuate our independence by destroying the vain hopes of all of its enemies, both at home and abroad. Three, you will encourage your allies to join with you, nay, to depend that what had been stipulated or shall hereafter be stipulated and agreed upon will be punctually performed, and other nations will be induced to enter into treaties with you. Four, it will have a tendency to break our parties and divisions, and by that means lay a firm and solid foundation for the future tranquility and happiness of the United States in general, and of this state in particular. Five, it will invigorate our commerce and encourage shipbuilding. Six, it will have a tendency not only to prevent any other nation from making war upon you, but from offering you any wrong or even insult. In short, the advantages that must result from it are obviously so numerous and important, and have been so fully and ably pointed out by others, that it appears to be unnecessary to enlarge on this head. Upon the whole, sir, the law has been my study from my infancy and my only profession. I have gone through the circles of offices in the legislative, executive, and judicial departments of government. From all my study, observation, and experience, I must declare that from a full examination and due consideration of this system, it appears to me the best the world has yet seen. I congratulate you on the fair prospect of its being adopted, and am happy in the expectation of seeing accomplished what has been long my ardent wish, that you will hereafter have a salutary permanency in magistracy and stability in the laws.
Okay, with that, we got, about 10 seconds before we go into break. So when we come back from break, what I want to do is I want to dive into the very top part where I kind of have it highlighted in red, because this is where we need to, what I'll do is I'll help you figure out what is the reality, because back in those days, people were doing label lynching by claiming that this was a consolidated government, it was a national government, it was a federation, blah, blah, blah. And what my challenge is let's boil it down to what the standards are today. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
So it's interesting that Mr. McKean goes off and says, I do not care, or I care not, whether it is called a consolidation, confederation, or national government, or by what other name, if it is a good government and calculated to promote the blessings of liberty, tranquility, and happiness. Now, me, myself, I would have jumped on accuracy. I would have actually challenged those people by definition. So this is what I challenge you to do, folks, because there's lots of people out there, and them being patriots, like the sovereign citizen movement and so forth, they believe that this government has been consolidated. Anybody that says that, just, you know, they say this without thinking, I think. You know, maybe with the biases of how they have studied the government and the framing and so forth, that they feel justified in saying the anti-federalists were right. That flies in the face of these reasonable, educated, literate men in these debates that determined that this Constitution was not that, what they're claiming, what the anti-federalists were claiming. So you got to be, you know, it. Oh, I don't mind being contrarian. I don't mind being the one that's, you know, saying the bad thing, because, you know, at least I'm bold for being out there with the truth. And this has nothing to do with the truth. The truth is that this was a government that you now need to prove is consolidated or is a national government, is a federation. If you look, when you look at a republic, there's only two forms of a republic that I understand, where they've come together, they've created a union. You're either a confederation or you're a federation. Now, because we call the general government a federal government, most people think that, oh, well, we're a federation. Guess what? They called the general government during the Articles of Confederation a federal government as well, because their definition of a federal government was basically a general government, a government that oversaw a union of states. When you look at the definition of a federation, the government itself, that government formed of a federation and a confederation, what is the significant difference between a federation and confederation? When you read the confederation, it is a government that has been a central government, a general government or a federal government that has been formed with limited and defined powers. A federation is where the mass of powers have been granted to the central government, that the states become administrative. Now, Madison's plan was creating a federation. It was rejected. The framework of the government was accepted, but the concept of pulling all power in to the federal government by creating, and, you know, at that point in time, they didn't even have the Constitution framed. But the concept was that the state governments would become administrative governments that would basically support and have very limited independent powers. That they, because remember, in Madison's plan, that the federal government could basically nullify or, you know, veto any laws within states that they felt were dangerous or incongruent with the spirit of the Federation. Is that the government that we have? Show me in these documents that that was the end results, and this is how the Constitution is being discussed. See, the anti-federals got away with saying all sorts of things. They were libeling the Constitution. They were libeling the Federalists. The Federalists at this point in time was this supposedly this pure view of the Constitution, of these limited powers and so forth. What ended up happening after the Federalists moved forward going into this federal government or into the general government as representatives in the House of Representatives and in the Senate, and those who started serving in the judiciary as well as the presidency, they started basically ignoring what and how the Constitution was defined. Over the years, folks, I have proven to you that Madison, throughout his life, consistently laid out that the only way you can look and determine what is constitutional, what isn't constitutional, is through one set of documents. Sean, what is that set of documents?
The ratification debates.
There it is, because he says it didn't matter to me in 1821. He says it didn't matter to me what we meant the Constitution to be in the convention or any of the framers in the convention. The only thing that matters is how the states understood the Constitution at its time of ratification. Again, pointing to the essence of contract law. Now, I know there's a lot of people that say, oh, Madison was inconsistent. And some of these people have written books and they, you know, wow, this guy's, you know, pretty prominent in the academic circles. Got a doctor next to his name. Doesn't mean he's right. I mean, Madison may have contradicted himself on, you know, what's the best drink for, you know, for your health. He may have contradicted himself. I have no evidence that he ever contradicted himself on what the guide should be and must be in trying to understand this Constitution. When we're disputing, we don't understand it. What do you use to actually, you know, weed through and find the real answer? It is the ratification debates. He said that over and over. He started off his career as a legislator in Congress saying that very same thing. And all the way out to 1834, in the notes on nullification, he reinforced that concept. Reinforced the concept of contract law, that the states are the final arbiters, blah, blah, blah. Because they're the ones that have defined this Constitution that was acceptable for them to empower this government and form this general government and so forth. So anyway, anyhow, your challenge, folks, let me get back to this so that we can just move forward, because then we'll go into the Massachusetts debates if Sean doesn't have anything else that he wants to bring up. But your challenge is show me in these ratification debates where in any way this is a consolidated government. Anything more than the Articles of Confederation, other than the granting of taxation and execution. In other words, the ability to do what it's necessary, it was supposed to be able to do when they formed the government. They should have granted those powers to it. Everything else was kept from it, which means it was a confederation, which is why when Jefferson was president, he consistently referred to the Union and the Republic as a confederation. He never looked at this as a federation, which is why he kind of stayed within his box, within his framework. He didn't try to edict by using an executive order and grant himself, you know, land or the ability. If you go back to the 1803, when you look at the amendment that he proffered to Congress, regarding the Indians, the Louisiana Territory, mineral rights, all of these types of things he wanted to see get injected so that the federal government could control these things. He didn't do it via EO. He submitted an amendment to the Constitution. So regardless of, you know, how, you know, he may have tripped or stumbled or what have you, he still at least followed the constitutional processes by not being a tyrant. He was never really a tyrant. Never. I can't see how he was ever a tyrant. He tried to stay within the law and the framework of the Constitution, which I think that's the whole point. Between him and Madison, they were our best presidents. Madison first, Jefferson second. Jefferson probably one of the most important people in our history because of the Declaration of Independence. George Washington, the father of this nation, because he alone, through his discipline and everything else, you know, led the revolution. And towards the demise of the Confederation, he brought us back together under the Constitution as the president. Was he a great president? No. And he didn't understand the Constitution. He tried. Was he a really bad president? No. We've had really bad presidents, but he was better than Adams. I mean, Adams did some good things, and he was right in some things, but Adams was better than a lot. I'm just saying that when you kind of go through the grades, if you understand what they did and how they behaved, I mean, I actually, maybe Washington wasn't much better than Adams. Maybe they were pretty on the even keel, because shoot, Washington signed the Assumption Act and the Bank Act. Adams signed the Alien Sedition Acts. I mean, you know, going through this, it is your challenge, back to this, it is your challenge to determine, are we a confederation, federation, consolidated, national, what are we? If your answer isn't confederation, then you need to read through these ratification debates another time, if you haven't read them already. Because it is clear that this is a very limited and defined and constrained government. It cannot just assume powers. It has no general powers at all. Anyway, so with that, we can kind of move forward into the Massachusetts debates. And so... Any go-backs before we jump into the Massachusetts debates, by the way?
I was just wondering, it just struck me as curious. Is that why the South called themselves the Confederate States of America? To emphasize the states' rights and
well, so,
a confederation and not a federation?
Well, so they didn't want to use the word union, because that's how the North was differentiated. Well, I mean, the Union was the motto. I mean, when you go through the... If you remember, we read the Constitutional Convention. In going through the Constitutional Convention, Madison's notes, many times they talked about the importance of the Union, right?
Yes,
I mean,
sir.
That's why the Southern states, they made these compromises to preserve the Union. That they needed to do this to preserve the Union. So they figured out ways of keeping everybody kind of, you know, in the room. I think when you really look at the Confederation of States, they may have, and I never read their Constitution, they may have actually written a better Constitution of more limited, defined, or whatever. I doubt it. I really doubt it, because what they did was not through, you know, it wasn't the same process of how we came as and how we evolved from the tyranny of England to rise up to finally decide to fight for ourselves and evolve from the Articles of Association and the Articles of Confederation while we were under the heels of the king, to finally, when we got out from underneath that and started realizing the failings and this, you know, our demise was around the corner. So to go form a convention to consider alterations where and actually invite the hand of God into the proceedings to guide them. That was, I don't think that, that was done with the South in the same tone at all. I don't think that that was done at any other point in time. As a matter of fact, I kind of wonder why you don't hear about that in the forming of the states either. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I mean, I wasn't going into that. I just meant the word itself.
The word itself.
Confederation.
Yeah, the word confederation. So,
right.
I don't think that maybe the words themselves were that important. Let me ask you this. Have you ever heard of the term federalism?
Yes.
That's actually a term, federalism. You can look it up. Have you ever heard the term confederalism?
No, sir.
Look it up. It's actually a term. And so it's not in our vocabulary. Why is that? Because over time, when the consolidators started getting their toehold in our government, they started changing. They started propagating the idea of federalism, nationalism, this, you know, unlimited government. They started subverting and getting rid of any of these types of words, ideas, and so forth that were commonly used in tandem back in our framers' days. Like I said, Thomas Jefferson did refer to the Union as a confederation. And as a matter of fact, I think during his presidency, there he muttered or at least expressed himself that he couldn't wait to finally get back home to, you know, to the state of Virginia. And he actually, I think he called it a nation or something to that effect. And when you think about it, the federal government is a nation of nations, or I should say the Union is a nation of nations, that this general government only serves this nation of nations. Very similar concept of what the EU tried to do with Europe, and they still are failing because they didn't do it like we did, because the state still didn't give up power. I mean, the EU is just lipstick on a pig. They don't have any of these real... I think they've been trying to consolidate and get more power into the EU, but there's too many states that will not surrender that power. And we saw in America that we had more little states than big states, but still, even the big states still ratified. They still came into the Union because the methodology was bypassing the cabal, those who were at the trough of power at that point in time. They went out to the people and said, send us your delegates and you debate this Constitution to determine whether this is best for you or not. That's why they said it was taken to the people instead of the state legislatures. Even though the people that went were the same people that, you know, kind of been cycling through government, but it was a much larger body than what you would have in your legislature. Much larger. So anyway. Anything else?
No, sir.
Okay.
But I did look that up real quick, and yeah, that was one of the indicators. That was one of the part of the impetus for them to name it a Confederate States, because they wanted to make sure that it was decentralized and based on the compact theory that the federal government was formed by the states for their purposes.
Okay, good. So when we kind of look at how they formed their constitution, because like I said, I never read it. And did they dissolve it? Did the Articles of Confederation dissolve? Did we destroy, or not the Articles of Confederation? Did this new confederation that was stood up in Richmond, Virginia, when we won the war, did that mean that we forced them back in, that we destroyed that? Is that what that meant? I mean, there were some peace agreements, sure, and so forth. And I think that this is when Lincoln was really showing his, I'm going to make you pay. How dare you put me in a position where I was going to look and die as an abject failure of life? And Lincoln wanted more than a pound of flesh. Lincoln was was in a position now where he could actually destroy, you know, anybody that thought contrary to him. He was at the epitome of being a demigod. And so I can easily see the divine hand of providence sparing us of having Lincoln, you know, basically maintain a presidency for 2-3 more terms and making sure that, you know, this the consolidation of power and everything else, you know, would actually transfer this nation or transform this nation into something that it was not designed to do. So to me, I just see that he was necessary in actually ending slavery, that, you know, we had to go through this, and Mason basically predicted it. I can see how we had to suffer for maintaining it. But Lincoln himself, he only served that purpose because he was hard-hearted, and it was about him, not about what was right with God. And I think it wasn't until he started prostrating himself, but how many people, you know, get down and they humble themselves, get down and ask, hey, you know, God, help. You know, I'm in my despair. I mean, I'm looking bad here. Help me out. You know, I love you. I'll do anything. Those are the famous words of the desperate. And so he prostrated himself. He listened to, you know, converting this about not, you can't leave the Union, but this is about freeing the slaves. Right, wrong, or indifferent, he changed the tone, which changed the, I'll just say, the attitude of the northern states and those fighting. It wasn't about whether you could leave the Union anymore. It's, we're getting rid of slavery. That being said, we got 6 minutes. Now, let me kind of introduce the Massachusetts debates. I've already said this. This is the Puritans coming together and the Puritans really working through this argument that they should not be debating this Constitution. Every anti-federalist went through this. Now, I've got lots of things that are highlighted in this ratification debate, lots of things. Like the whole first couple pages are all highlighted. We're not going to go through those. I would recommend reading them. And so what we're going to go through is we're going to go through because the very first few pages, there's not a lot of detailed debates. Now, we'll find, let me see here, let me get down to where we find moral bankruptcy. And you'll find the moral bankruptcy is on Wednesday, January 16th. We're going to kind of, I don't want to rush through these, but, and I may do some go-backs because there's some things that I do want to see if I can find that have kind of added to my queue of searching that we just, out of Pennsylvania, that I hadn't had time to do yet, like Via Voca. I want to find out if they, too, identified that elections were done primarily via voice instead of by secret ballot and so forth. But the moral bankrupt part under Mr. Pierce, where Mr. Pierce begins to, I believe it's Mr. Pierce. Yeah, Mr. Pierce from Partridge Field. Now, you're going to notice that next to many of these men's names, it says Reverend. So lots of the people in Massachusetts that went to the convention were reverends because they, you know, they were a layman's community. I mean, there were churches everywhere, and the churches were just large enough to serve the people of the town or the neighborhood or the community, what have you. But anyway, let's go ahead and dive into the moral bankrupt state. Go ahead.
After reading the fourth section, wish to know the opinion of gentlemen on it, as Congress appeared thereby to have a power to regulate the time, place, and manner of holding elections. In respect to the manner, said Mr. Pierce, suppose the legislature of this state should prescribe that the choice of the federal representatives should be in the same manner as that of governor, a majority of all the votes in the state being necessary to make it such, and Congress should deem it an improper manner and should order that it be as practiced in several of the southern states,
where the highest number of votes makes a choice. Had they not power by this section to do so? Again, as to the place, continued Mr. P., may not Congress direct that the election for Massachusetts shall be held in Boston? And if so, it is possible that previous to the election, a number of the electors may meet, agree upon the 8 delegates, and propose the same to a few towns in the vicinity, who agreeing in sentiment may meet on the day of the election and carry their list by a major vote. He did not, he said, say that this would be the case, but he wished to know if it was not a possible one. As the federal representatives who are to form the democratical part of the general government are to be a check on the representatives' sovereignty, the Senate, he thought the utmost caution ought to be used to have their elections as free as possible. He observed that, as men have ever been fond of power, we must suppose they ever will continue so, and concluded by observing that our caution ought in the present case to be greater, as by the proposed Constitution, no qualification of property was required in a representative, and it might be in the power of some people thereby to choose a bankrupt for a representative in order to give such representatives employment, or that he might make laws favorable to such a description of people. Prophecy everywhere in here.
Yeah, so here's an interesting thing, because this points to this very end, points to the concept of what are the limitations a state can place on a person wanting to be the representative of their congressional district, for the people in their congressional district. Obviously, they said, hey, we can't create qualifications of property. Can you create qualifications of party affiliation?
Mm-hmm.
Can you create qualifications of money getting on the ballot? You have to have so much money. In other words, they're basically saying a bankrupt person could become a member of Congress, because you couldn't stop that from happening. And yet, every state has created barriers in access to every federal seat, period. Every federal seat has barriers that literally violate. This has all been done to preserve the party. Folks, I am highlighting here how the party has been getting away with violating the Constitution by creating barriers to entry. They're controlling this, and they use primaries to obliterate and remove anybody that will not do their bidding. In other words, if you want a constitution-compliant candidate, in many cases and places, the party will do everything it can to stop that person from getting in. And they're doing it all unconstitutionally. So with that, boom, we're literally done. So with that, you know, even though we're finding these concepts that, and I don't identify everybody being anti-federalist, but I can tell you that there are a lot of people, you can tell those people who are really in favor of the Constitution and those who are objective. And Mr. Pierce is being an objective man. We'll be back with more of the Massachusetts debates. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.